You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spokley Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. General Michael Hayden is the former director of both the CIA and the NSA. He joins New York Times editor Philip Taubman to speak about Russian hacking during the last election and how to stop leaked NSA tools from being turned into ransomware.
I'm here today because General Hayden kindly agreed to come to Stanford 5 years ago when I launched a course at Stanford based on my 30 years of experience as a reporter and editor at the New York Times. And particularly because when I was serving as Washington bureau chief of the Times, it was at that moment that the Times learned for the first time about post-9/11 NSA eavesdropping operations, which, of course, we all subsequently learned much more about years later from Edward Snowden. And they commenced a discussion with the Bush administration about whether the Times was going to publish that story. And General Hayden, who at the time was the director of NSA, and I were appointed, in effect, as the two point persons for those discussions. I obviously represented the New York Times and General Hayden, the Bush administration. And these discussions went on for over a year. I won't go into any detail now. We ended up holding the story for a year, as many of you may remember, and eventually we published it. So that was the beginning of my relationship with General Hayden. And so when I decided to retire and come to Stanford and teach and write books and do a course on press government conflicts over the disclosure of national security secrets, I thought, gee, wouldn't it be great if General Hayden came out and met with my students on the week in which we discussed this showdown between the Times and the Bush administration, which he kindly did. And he returned yesterday for a encore performance. And so he, of course, is here today with a bigger audience. So General Hayden really needs no introduction. I'll just remind you that he served as director of the National Security Agency. It was in that job when he was dealing with me, and then he subsequently became the first principal DNI, Director of National Intelligence, and then completed his government service as director of the CIA. And he's now a principal at the Chertoff Group in Washington. So when I invited General Hayden, I guess it was last fall, to come and speak to my class and come to CSAC in mid-May, I sort of suspected there might be a little bit that we could talk about, but there is definitely no shortage of issues to discuss today. So we'll, General Hayden and I will have a conversation for maybe 40 minutes or so, and then open it up for all of you to ask questions of him. So I think as a ex-news paper editor, you know, I'm drawn to the news. So let's start with the most recent news, which the item I will pick is among many
door one, yeah, right. Okay.
Is the furor that developed just this week over the disclosure that President Trump had shared some classified information with the Russian foreign minister and Russian ambassador in Washington. And that blew up into a major controversy, which of course was, you know, subsequently overshadowed by other events this week. But let me ask you, as someone who was spent many years dealing with the most classified government intelligence and also dealing with relationships with allies with whom the United States shares intelligence and depends on that sharing, why don't you walk us through, I know you were not involved with this particular episode, but given your background, why don't you walk us through what issues you think were raised and what damage sure. might have been done in this instance.
Okay. Good. Is this on? Doesn't sound like it's on. No?
Better? Now it is.
All warmed up now. All right. Thanks, Phil. This is kind of a multi-layered response to Phil's direct question. I mean, kind of think of it as diagnosis, all right? So one element is a fever, and fever hurts, and that's important. But generally, fever represents something deeper going on inside the body, right? So you've got symptom, and then you've got the real issue. So telling the Russians information that went beyond his briefing points, went beyond his portfolio, probably that the institutions of government had agreed with very good reason should not be shared with the Russians. Breaking the pledge, what we call the third party doctrine, which is if you give me something, I can't give it to someone else unless you've given me your approval, which is really a holy writ inside the intelligence community. We really do respect that, even though, as you might imagine, it becomes bureaucratically burdensome to make sure you've got a tag on all the information you have so you know what's yours and what's not yours. That's bad enough, okay? That causes harm. So much harm, if you kind of read the broad outlines of the story, it caused Tom Bossert, who's a pretty senior guy under H.R. McMaster, to call NSA and CIA to warn them that the president had gone beyond this material, had shared it with the Russians. So, I mean, clearly this is not a trivial coloring outside the line. It's important. That said, though, we're still in the symptoms box here. That's probably manageable. We can probably make that fever go down. Now, I know the speculation that it was Israeli information, but frankly, it almost doesn't matter whose it was. It's probably manageable. And the reasons it's manageable is that everybody wants to be friends with CIA and NSA. I mean, the flow of information between American intelligence and any partner, the flow is dominated by the American information going in that direction. And so they would be insulted, they would be angered, they would be worried, they may be a little more cautious going forward, but I think they'll swallow hard and there will not be any lasting damage to the relationship. So again, it's not unimportant. Third party rules there for a reason. You do it too much, you start not getting intel, but manageable. What I think the backdrop is, and Phil, this is why I think it kind of went viral and why people pushed the information out the door, was that it was symptomatic of a broader pattern of behavior of an administration and actually a president who was on a good day spontaneous, on a bad day erratic, not well briefed, not interested in being well briefed, doesn't do his homework, feels as if his instinctive way of handling situations will be quite sufficient for these kinds of meetings. And I think the bureaucracy pushed this out the door, not because of the great offense here, but because they're starting to see the handwriting on the wall that the pattern of life that they're about to enter is doing an awful lot of sweeping up behind a White House that just can't, won't, doesn't get control of itself. So I think that's really the issue. It's the pattern rather than the specific. I mean, I'll give you another one. So we lean on our South Korean allies to put THAAD, Theater High Altitude Air Defense missiles, in the southwest corner of the country. I mean, it benefits South Korea, but it's a card we want to play in the triangular match with North Korea and the Chinese. And this thing's got radar fans that sweep almost all of Manchuria. So the Chinese begin to hyperventilate that, oh my, this is threatening us. You put it, it's not. I mean, we get a better look into China, but that's really not why we did it. But the Chinese don't accept that. So they really turned the screws up on the South Koreans. I mean, there's a rich economic dialogue, trade between the two countries, including a lot of tourism. And the Chinese put a lot of pressure on the South Koreans through their economic levers, and the South Koreans suffered for it, seriously. And there's a South Korean election going on, and it's not a scheduled one. It's there because the previous president had been impeached. And the THAAD deployment is part of the campaign. And then the president is a stray electron, our president, as a stray electron when talking about THAAD and says, yeah, one more thing. They got to pay for it too. That's $1 billion over there and they're going to pay for it. And I'm going to renegotiate that trade deal too because we're going to sell more stuff to Korea. And so then H.R. McMaster, National Security Advisor, looks like those guys with the broom behind the circus parade, okay? And he's got to call the South Koreans, in essence, say, pay no attention to the words of the President of the United States. And so, long answer, but it's important that you can cabin the immediate thing, and if it were a one-off, it probably might not have leaked, but because it's part of this broader thing, I think the permanent government, which I think is a better phrase than the deep state, it's kind of pushing back saying this got to stop.
So I want to come back to the broader picture for a second, but you would have as good an idea as anybody as to whether the disclosures of the type of disclosure that the president made to the Russians in effect expose sources and methods for collection of the information about the laptop threat. So what did you, how seriously would you characterize that?
So a couple of second order effects, all right? And so when H.R. McMaster, whom I have the highest regard for, goes out there and says, the president did not discuss sources and methods. I then wrote, it's appeared in the Post, this Washington Post this morning, I then wrote, when I was talking to people like him, and he would say, we're not talking about sources and methods. One of my constant arguments was, very often, yeah, you're just talking about fact of, right. And then my point was, yes, and in many instances, fact of points in the direction of fact how. And that the release of the fact provides information that a good intelligence service could then work their way backward to the source. And so there is a danger there. There really is. The other interesting part is I keep referring to H.R. McMaster going out there and saying these things. And I already told you the regard I have for him. That's not a good thing, that the National Security Advisor is being rolled out as part of what might fairly be called the political defense of the president for an unarguable misstep. I can't imagine that he or Dina Powell, who is his deputy, whom I also know and have high regard for, I cannot imagine they were comfortable doing that. So to kind of answer to both questions, Phil, I mean, there are concentric circles of harm going out from the event.
And would you guess, I know you don't know the sources and methods that were used in this case, but would you suspect that the technique that was used or the collection method that was used is proven now to be unusable going forward?
I don't know the specifics, all right? I'm purely speculating. I don't go back for briefings, okay? My sense is this is probably a technical collection activity, rather, but it may be enabled by high-risk human activity, just given the nature of the target. And so you've got these things. Look, technical collection can be ended by this simple action. All right, you just stop using the communications device, and you're done. Doesn't matter. You put a gajillion dollars in to creating access. When it's revealed, the cure is really quite cheap for the other side. Hang up the phone.
Let's segue over to the Russian hacking during the campaign. You know a lot about cybersecurity. For a lay person like me, the storyline looked absurdly easy from the Russian standpoint. The Clinton campaign was wholly unprepared in terms of cybersecurity. Is this typical of our political party institutions? Is this typical of our government institutions in Washington? Are we child's play for the Kremlin or for China or other nations that want to interfere in our internal processes?
Yeah, we probably are. I mean, this is hard. Don't need to be condemnatory of anybody. I mean, this stuff happens. And if you've got a persistent, advanced persistent threat, you're not stopping them. They're getting in. Now, we probably didn't make them expend a whole lot of energy. Now, President Ilves is here. These guys have suffered in Estonia through an attack, and because of that, have taken measures to make their web, which on which they rely even more than we do, tougher than ours. So we could do more, but it's hard to make this go away through just, in fact, you cannot make it go away through defensive measures. So to rehearse the story, almost certainly the Russian Federation used Russian criminal gangs and other affiliates, which is how they do this, so you get a bit of a cutout. The Russian criminal gangs are allowed to succeed, are allowed to exist inside the Federation. It's like Godfather 1, Scene 1, you know, when the wedding's on the lawn and the Godfather's holding court inside the library and the Undertaker comes and says, Godfather Don Corleone, my daughter, yes, I will grant you this favor, but I may come to you from time to time for a service. That's the relationship between Don Vladimir and the Russian cyber gangs. And I suspect President Ilves would confirm that an awful lot of what happened there in 2007 came from the gangs working on behalf of Russian foreign policy. And that's what happened here. So the gangs break through, go into the DNC, not a heavy lift, pull the information out and give it to the Russian security services. Okay, so far all we're talking about is honorable international espionage.
Okay.
Yeah. Which hey, if I could grab the emails from the United Russia, and if I thought they were worth anything, we'd do it in a heartbeat. All right. Getting the emails of a major political party inside a global competitor is an accepted international practice. All right. So far no foul. But then the Russians took the next step, which was to weaponize the information, to turn it around, push it back into the American information space through their subsidiary, WikiLeaks, through another whole set of sites they created called DC Leaks. And then they had an army of trolls who would touch the data and a whole bunch of other fake news stories, touch it in a way that the Google algorithms would think that the data was trending, pull it forward into the American information space, and then, to be really candid, opponents of Hillary Clinton would then forward and be part of the forwarding of these really outlandish news stories. It is not, by the way, that's all fact. We all know that. That's okay. And it's not forensics, right? It's everything that intelligence can do to say that that's true. It appears that the motivation moved throughout the campaign. At first, they just wanted to mess with our heads. Check. They did that. They wanted to punish her because he hates her, and he does, and they did. Then they wanted to injure and undercut the validation of soon-to-be President Clinton. And then August-ish, September-ish, they began to kind of say, that other guy could win. And then the high-confidence judgment of your intelligence services is they worked to put their thumb on the scale to actually move votes in the direction of Donald Trump. Now, that's all true. And they tried to affect the American election. Only two presidents on this planet who refused to say that last sentence. Ours and the Russian president. Everyone else agrees the Russians attempted to affect the outcome of the election. Their effect is not measurable. It's not just unknown, it is unknowable. And so I generally just say at this point, so we're done talking about that. Donald Trump is the legitimate president of the United States. But this stuff really, really did happen. So this is called a covert influence campaign. Other intelligence services in the world have conducted covert influence campaigns. As practitioners, they would be able to tell you that covert influence campaigns are unable to create fractures in a society. All covert influence campaigns can do is to exploit and worsen pre-existing fractures. And so, give the Russians credit, they knew us at least as well as we knew ourselves, knew our openings, and drove through those openings with their messaging. In terms of collaboration, okay, which is now the ongoing investigation, I will offer you the very harsh judgment that the only collaboration that covert influence campaign probably needed was an American political atmosphere in which people thought it was legitimate to chant "lock her up" at multiple campaign rallies, and an opposition candidate that validated the legitimacy of WikiLeaks. And beyond that, they probably didn't need any more help.
You know, I would observe as a journalist that there was also, whether witting or unwitting, very clever flipping of the American press, which I certainly would argue is one of the pillars of our democratic system, the free press. This campaign of hacking and then pushing stuff out through WikiLeaks flipped the free press into an instrument that furthered this campaign, because the press is impossibly competitive. That will never cease to be the case. And when John Podesta's sort of pedestrian emails were released, the news media was frantic in trying to publish that information. So you took organizations like the New York Times and Washington Post, which I think a lot of us would think of as organizations that are vital to the civic life of our country, and sort of turn them into a kind of antimatter in a very effective way. So what do you think the Vladimir Putin's end game is here?
Yeah. President Obama was right in saying that, you know, on their very best day, these guys have pretensions to be a regional power. Right? We're not going back to the bipolar world and the balance between ourselves and the Soviet Union. They have a lot of internal structural problems. And, you know, the economy, the population, which is going down, and lack of entrepreneurship, and difficulty of extracting oil and energy in tough to reach places, the global cost of oil and so on. So I said on Morning Joe, it's more than a year ago now, after one or another Russian sin, that, Joe, he's doing this with nothing more than a pair of sevens in his hand, right? I mean, he's got no picture cards. But he keeps bidding the pot. And he keeps bidding it because, frankly, up to that point, no one was bidding against him. Folks weren't pushing back. I said this last night over dinner, and it's a little bit of a silly metaphor, but I think it really does have a whole lot of truth. So if you picture, we're all here eating lunch, okay? Just picture if we'd had a little kid's table over here, all right? That's where Vlad's got to sit, okay? Because his country doesn't have all the stuff that the big people have, all right? And he knows he can't make that his chair at that table much bigger. Back to the limits, the declining population, the declining entrepreneurship, the lack of democracy, and so on. But he really does want to eat that big table. In fact, his legitimacy as a Russian leader is based on the promise, I'm going to get us back to the big table. Sure, certainly can't be quality of life, right? But I'm going to take care of your pride here. But he can't make his table or his chair any bigger. So every night, he comes over here near our big people table with a saw. And every night he cuts off about a quarter of an inch from the big person's table. And he does that over a long period of time, so that sooner or later that big people's table is going to be so low that he's going to slide his chair over and it's going to look like it fits. It's going to look like it belongs. That, in my Saturday morning cartoon way, is my explanation for the attack on American democracy, French democracy, German democracy, the support for Brexit, the attack on the European Union, and the attack on the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's to pull us down to a level where he now can be competitive with what he knows are his limited tools.
Let's switch over to ransomware.
To the happy news?
Yes. We'll switch over to another item in the news these days, the ransomware attack. So this goes right back to your old agency at NSA. They cooked up a lot of this stuff, and then it leaked out, and now it's come back to torment all of us. What the hell's going on, Mike, if I may ask you?
I see our time is up. So there are a lot of factors bearing on the problem. So if you get my book, Chapter 9 is the one about the cyber domain. And frankly, it is the least remarked chapter in the book when I go out and talk about it. And it was the toughest one to clear. And so there's actually a lot of stuff in there. And one of the things that I talk about in Chapter 9 is our putting an office called TAO, Tailored Access Operations on steroids. That is the office that we would have used to go after United Russia's emails. All right, it is the active signal. You know, normal signals intelligence, you got the antenna in the ether, you're waiting for a communication. Tailored Access is, don't wait for them to send it, let's just go to where they keep it. We bust into the network, we extract it, all right? So we really began to accelerate, in my time there, TAO, Tailored Access Operation, active SIGIN, commute to the target, steal the data from the network, don't wait for them to transmit it. All right. That stuff that was allegedly leaked in Vault 7?
No, that's CIA.
That's CIA. Anyway, in whatever they've lived.
Shadow Brokers.
Yeah, thank you. That is allegedly from the TAO toolbox. All right, the tools that Tailored Access Office developed. I don't go back for briefings. I can't confirm what I'm reading in the press, but it sounds plausible. And I've already told you what I know. What I can tell you, yeah, we do that, and we stockpile these kinds of tools. There are a couple of really interesting subplots here. So one is what we call the equities decision. So if you believe the press, and I just have to say it that way, okay? So if I forget to say that, pretend I said it throughout, based on press accounts, all right? NSA discovers this vulnerability inside of Windows XP and then develops a tool that allows it to exploit that vulnerability. Whenever NSA discovers a vulnerability, it has to make a legal, operational, and moral decision. What do I do with my knowledge of the vulnerability? You realize that NSA has both offensive and defensive responsibilities. It steals other legitimate intelligence targets' information, but it also is designed to protect Americans from similar activity from foreign actors. So now you've got a vulnerability in Windows XP. NSA has to make a decision. Patch it, make it public and patch it, or keep it secret and exploit it. We've always had to make that decision. That decision has existed since the agency began. But the circumstances, the ambient background within which that decision is made now is really quite different. Because in most cases, when we discover a vulnerability, it's a vulnerability on a piece of equipment that is almost always in broad general use, including use by people protected by the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It's not a hole in the Russian cryptographic system for strategic rocket forces, which you probably wouldn't care about. Whereas a hole in Windows XP, you might, if you're still using Windows XP. Right? And so you had this equities decision. The fulcrum between offensive and defense is shifting because more and more the vulnerability is discovered not in the isolated network of a legitimate foreign target, but is discovered in a piece of kit that is in general use. Another dynamic that we used in the vulnerability, the equities decision, is a concept we called NOBUS, N-O-B-U-S. Nobody but us. And it meant was, there's a hole there. But if it is so hard to find, and if it is so hard to exploit, unless you're a multi-billion dollar national security agency, unless it requires something like NSA to exploit it, then the instinct is let it ride. Because even though the vulnerability continues, others can't take advantage of it. That's shifting too, because the universe of NOBUS is actually getting smaller as other nations and even private sector elements become more and more talented. So you had this gap vulnerability in Windows XP. I don't know this, but connecting the dots about what it is I know, it appears that NSA informed Microsoft, and that triggered Microsoft issuing the patch last March for the vulnerability that this exploited. And then it was just a question, well, who had good systems administrators and who didn't? When you look at where it was most effective, the lion's share of the badness where in countries like China, Russia, and the Ukraine, who are almost certainly using pirated Microsoft software that would not normally then get the patches and the updates from those who were using licensed equipment. The second major issue, sorry, this is a long answer, but it's a pretty rich question. The second major question is, okay, I got the vulnerability part, Hayden. I see how that kind of worked. How about the weapon part? How about the tool you developed to go do this? That's honorable espionage. In the book, I talk about how we just put the throttle all the way forward to develop these kinds of tools. I am comfortable with that. I can defend that. I know how we use them. We don't use them against you, even though you do use XP. We use them against other people who use XP. I mean, I can win that argument. Phil and I talked about this yesterday. The argument I can't win, however, is, but if you can't keep control of the weapon, why will I let you have it in the first place? It's a little bit like, well, yeah, we've lost a couple of B2s, but still, they're good. We need to keep them. I mean, it's in that realm. And so Phil pointed out a quote of mine in yesterday's New York Times, in which he thought it was a little stark, in which I said, look, I can defend what these agencies do. I cannot defend their losing control of their tools. And if they can't control their tools, then we have to seriously consider whether or not we will allow them to have such tools. That's how serious an issue I think this
would be. You know, I think that speaking of that same story, Scott Shane, who wrote it, is someone you know as well.
Yeah.
So it really raises the broader question where you've got a multi-billion-dollar American intelligence agency that is developing technologies of a order completely different from the weapons technologies that we were accustomed to in our history until recent decades and recent years. The current technologies, if they get out, can be turned against the American people. They can be turned against citizens all around the world. That is an entirely different ballgame. In some ways, the only weapons systems that we developed that had this global capacity for destruction, nuclear weapons. So doesn't this raise a real ongoing long-term problem for NSA and how it is going to maintain the confidence of the American people and the Congress?
I that's why I gave Scott the quote. I felt he called me and I felt he had already written the story. And the story is about you lost that, what's going on? I mean, just going through all the things that had happened. And he said, you got anything to add? I said, yeah. And I gave him the quote. I can prove what it is they're doing is effective, lawful, and appropriate according to U.S. constitutional concerns, reasonable expectation of privacy, laws of armed conflict, accepted international practice, check. I can win that. I can't win. If you can't control them, I don't know how the American people should be expected to let you keep them. And so that is a really important question now for the leadership of the agencies, both NSA and CIA, that I headed. Yep.
Let's widen the aperture here for a sec. Oh, go ahead.
Can you say at all about why they're not able to keep control?
All these incidents took place long after I left government, and therefore, I don't know. You know, you would have thought Manning would have been a wake-up call. And frankly, that was bad, but that was down at the secret level.
Right.
That was irritating, not all that destructive. Although there were dangers, okay. But when you go up to Snowden and to this stuff here, that's really into the most precious stuff we have that should be compartmented, cabined, limited access, and so on. And now they're rolling out. It appears that we are most victim by insiders. And the newness is the insiders are not working for anyone else. If you think of how we catch spies, it's because spies are working for these people, and you catch the connective tissue going back to the state actor for whom they work. Or more ideally, you penetrate the other state actor and learn who's working for them, which is the best counterintelligence technique. These folks are sui generis. All right, they are self-motivated. to go do that. And therefore the first time you learn, the first time you should learn that something's wrong is when they start downloading things they shouldn't have. And if you miss that, your next indicator is stuff showing up in the outside world. So all the tools you've practiced and developed for counterintelligence were kind of built to stop state-sponsored spies. And now you've got this whole new phenomenon.
So this will be my last question. Those of you who have questions, Harold is going to keep a list, so you can indicate to him now if you want to ask a question. Mike, if you pull back a bit, how would you assess the greatest strategic threats to the United States over the next 10, 15 years?
Yeah. Thanks, Phil. What I do, and I get asked that a lot, and so what I do to answer it is it's not a dodge of the question, but it's the only way you can't answer it. So I create this little XY axis thing here, okay? This is how bad could it be, and this is how much time you got, okay? And so what I do is I say down here, not existential, but it could go bump tonight. I throw in terrorism and even cyber, all right? Because I don't think cyber reaches the existential level yet, all right? They're important. I'm not downplaying them, all right? But in the broader scheme of things, what's really driving them is their urgency and immediacy. Somebody at SFO, some youngster makes a bad decision at SFO tonight, we could be looking at the lower corner of the graph and saying that was a bad thing. So down here, important, more urgent than catastrophic or apocalyptic, terrorism, cyber threat. Then I go out here 3 to 5, 6, and I got another bubble. This one's further up the vertical axis, so it's more serious. And there I've got a shot group of states that I label overall ambitious, fragile, and nuclear. And there I put the North Koreans, the Pakistanis, I throw the Iranians in there, because that agreement ages off. And that's where I group the Russians. Okay. And then I go out here 10 to 12, and then I got a bubble way up here, more important than either of those. And that bubble I label the Sino-American relationship. And I'm careful to label it the Sino-American relationship, not China, because I don't want you to think of China the same way just looped in North Korea. It's getting that relationship right is probably the pass-fail effort of the 21st century. So, anyhow.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Cheryl.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spokley Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.